Russia has halted gas supplies to Poland and Bulgaria. It says the two nations refuse to pay in rubles. The EU calls it blackmail and says it has contingency plans. But can Europeans survive without Russian gas? This is Inside Story. Hello there and welcome to the programme. I'm Laura Kyle. The crisis between Russia and Europe, sparked by the war in Ukraine, has taken yet another turn. This time, Moscow has delivered on its promise to halt gas supplies to Bulgaria and Poland for not paying in rubles, Russia's currency. Though the action had been feared by some in the European Union, many had already predicted it. Bulgaria says it's made alternative arrangements and Poland insists its energy supplies are secure. At the start of the conflict, the US agreed to provide liquefied natural gas to the EU in the coming years. And member states are working to find alternative long-term supplies as well. European leaders are calling Russia's move blackmail and are promising to respond.
Gazprom's announcement that it is unilaterally stopping gas deliveries to certain EU member states is another provocation from the Kremlin. But it comes as no surprise that the Kremlin uses fossil fuels to try to blackmail us. This is something the European Commission has been preparing for in close coordination and solidarity with member states and international partners. Our response will be immediate, united and coordinated.
Well, the European Council President Charles Michel echoed a similar message on Twitter, saying Gazprom's decision to cut gas supplies to some EU member states is another aggressive unilateral move by Russia. We will remain united and support each other while phasing out Russian energy imports. Well, some in the EU see this as an opportunity to revisit the issue of renewable energy sources. To achieve that, the EU would need to raise the share of its green energy to 40% of total consumption by 2030. Another step would be to collectively reduce net greenhouse gas emissions by 55% from 1990 levels by 2030. And the EU may have to divert its attention to alternatives like liquefied natural gas and, even more controversially, resort to reactivating its coal-powered plants. Well, ending its reliance on Russian gas will not be an easy task for Europe. The EU received more than 40% of its supplies from Russia before the war. About a third of that went through Ukraine. Germany is the biggest single consumer, accounting for 55% of its total imports. But it's now promised to phase out Russian imports. Bulgaria, which has just been cut off by Gazprom, receives more than 70% of its natural gas from Russia, while Poland gets more than 45%. Well, let's bring in our guests now. And joining us from Berlin, Andreas Goldfau, professor at the Willy Brandt School of Public Policy. In Moscow, Chris Wiefer, chief executive officer at the consultancy Macro Advisory. And in Oslo, Ulle Valby, a commodities analyst at SEB Financial Services Group. A very warm welcome to all of you. Let's start this discussion by addressing this issue of actually paying for Russia's gas in rubles. Why Poland and Bulgaria have refused to do it, who else might be doing it, and why Russia wants it in the first place. First, Ulle, why have Poland and Bulgaria defied Russia's demands?
What we're seeing is that Poland and Bulgaria are both now going away from Russia as a supply source of natural gas. And just also just going back 4 weeks, we saw that the Poland actually promoted the most radical plan in EU to de-Russify its energy imports. So basically what they stated that was there will be no Russian coal in 2 months' time. There will be no Russian oil by the end of 2022. And there will be no extension on their Russian natural gas contracts, which is about to expire at the end of 2022. So this has sort of been, this has been important politics in Poland and also Bulgaria, of course. So now we're seeing that this is an opportunity to go away from Russia as a supply source. And now we also see that they have alternatives.
And Bulgaria does as well, because it gets its vast majority of natural gas from Russia.
Exactly. That's a good point. But Bulgaria can get their gas from Azerbaijan. Now we see that they are signing more long-term contracts with Azerbaijan in gas.
Okay. Chris, let's look at Russia and why it's insisting on these rubles payments in the first place. I mean, I understand that Gazprom already has to sell 80% of its foreign currency earnings for Russian currency anyway. So why is it insisting on more of these ruble payments?
Yes, actually, just very quickly on what the previous speaker said, the reason why Russia has targeted Poland and Bulgaria is exactly as you said. These are the two countries that have been more proactive in looking for alternative sources and making specific arrangements for alternative gas supplies. And both countries were, in any case, going to drop Russia gas supplies at the end of the year. So it allows Russia, therefore, opportunistically to make a point to basically say to the other countries, we can do the same to you, even though the volumes would be a lot more significant and the impact would be a lot bigger because other countries like Germany, Italy, etc., have not made these arrangements because they're not possible. But as to why now, it's partly... This is something that President Putin and the government have talked about for a very long time, more than 10 years. The fact that they've wanted to break dependency on the dollar as the main currency for Russia's external trade. They've wanted more bilateral currency deals. There are some in place with China in rubles and Chinese yuan. So this is something that they've been, in any case, promoting for a long time. And now this is an opportunity to advance that. But actually, the reason why they're doing it specifically now is related to sanctions, because the mechanism that they've proposed or that they've put in place, which requires, for example, a customer in Europe to pay, still be able to pay in dollars or euros, but now into a bank account in Gazprom Bank, and Gazprom Bank then converts to rubles and transmits the rubles to Gazprom. So the customer can still pay in dollars or euros, but in this mechanism, and the EU commissioner saying that this mechanism is sanctions violating because it involves the Russian central bank, and hence they're opposed to it. So Russia is pushing it now in order to make the sanctions against the central bank, what shall we say, very uncomfortable for Europe and raising the stakes about future sanctions.
Absolutely. Well, it certainly has succeeded there in raising the stakes. Andreas, given the number of countries that are still receiving Russian gas at this time, can we assume that some or even many are actually paying in rubles?
Well, there are reports that this is already happening, or at least companies in at least three or four European countries are now paying in rubles, precisely along the lines of what Chris has just outlined. We don't precisely know whom. We have fair certainty on Hungary, probably Austria. I wouldn't rule out that some German companies are trying the same thing, given the rather difficult situation these days. And I'm not ruling out this is going to go, that number is going to go even higher up. I guess the key issue here really is, you know, where is the pressure? What kind of pressure is higher? The political pressure from the European side to stay in line, or essentially the pressure to keep up the gas supplies flowing? And that's where companies find themselves between a rock and a hard place at the moment.
Absolutely. Ule, the sanctions, it is said, are only as strong as their weakest link. Is this Russian move to insist on payment in rubles, thereby violating EU sanctions, according to the EU Commission president, is that working?
I think it's, you know, back to what the second speaker mentioned here. And we saw that EU's von der Leyen mentioned that paying in rubles will be viewed as a sanction violation, right? And I think that's what's driving the price, you know, that's what's driving the price, because Poland and as alone, it's not a major, there's no major issue for Poland at all. So it's more like a psychological thing, and more like a psychological effect on the market. And this is the power play Putin and Gazprom has been driving the last couple of 6+ months. Going back and I think it works in some way, because now you see that the countries which is really reliant on the Russian natural gas, they will now pay in rubles. That will be the consequence. And I think now the market now realizes the seriousness of the actions, and we see that even though the price didn't, like, of course it jumped back up quite a bit, but not not like a really huge extent. But what we saw happening was that the forward curve, the prices further out on the curve going forward, they went up. So I think the market's now realizing that this will be no easy and quick fix, right? So going forward, we will have higher prices for longer. And I think that's exactly also what Putin wants. And also one quick comment as well. I think, you know, Putin has been delivering on his long-term obligation, his long-term contracts all the time. You know, he's been playing with the spot volumes too much. So, and his goal is to make sure that his large consumers of natural gas, his customers in Europe, are now going into new long-term contracts, which is about to expire. You know, natural gas is like a marriage. You know, it's like a 20, 30 year handshake, you know, and this is exactly what he wants. So I think it sort of works, yes.
Okay. Would you agree with that, Chris? If you can sort of perhaps look into Putin's mind simply because you're there in Moscow. Do you think that this is his outlook?
Yeah, I think, first of all, as Uli said, Russia views these relationships over the very long term. And it is actually important to note that the Russian government always made a point that it will always honor contracts. So in this situation, it's about making life difficult for the European customers rather than perhaps risking the contracts, because German or other European customers can still pay in dollars or euros as per the contract, but they now have to pay into Gazprom Bank rather than to Gazprom, and hence the conversion to rubles from there. So essentially what Russia is saying is that technically the contract is not disrupted. It is only the payment mechanism that has changed. And therefore, they're again throwing the onus on Europe and the European customers to, as the EU Commission President said, to break sanctions. But Russia itself is saying, we're actually not doing much to the contracts, only changing where you pay, not how you pay or the terms of the contract itself. So in that sense, of course, Russia is in a strong position. Although you really have to always reflect on the fact that Russia and Europe are in a mutually difficult position. Europe needs the gas, but Russia needs the money. So in that sense, you're not going to get a situation where Russia will just arbitrarily turn the gas off, because it needs the financial lifeline in order to sustain the economy and provide employment subsidies and social subsidies, etc. The situation in Russia will be very difficult and very different tomorrow if those gas flows were cut off and the money stream was disrupted. So in that sense, there's a lot of bluffing. There's a game of brinksmanship. There's a game of chicken. It'll play out over the summer when, frankly, the energy market is requires maybe less volumes. It's a good time to play it. And the hope here in Moscow is, as far as I can hear, is that they hope that all of this will be resolved and dusted and finalized before we get to the autumn delivery season.
That will be interesting. Andreas, do you think Russia might lose this bluff? I mean, we've got the EU standing resolute, saying its response is immediate and coordinated. We know that they're coming up with this repower EU plan. Is it going to be enough to wean themselves off Russia's fossil fuels?
Well, I think there's two things. One, I think the jury's out whether the front is standing and holding. I mean, we need a coordinated European answer to the Russian demand. And at the moment, a couple of countries are there. Their companies are breaking out of that. And I think what's really, really needed is a coordinated response, and people working on this, whether it holds the jury's out. But then obviously the longer term question is, you know, does Europe need Russia's gas going forward? And, you know, 2 months ago or 3 months ago, I would have said, yes, well, it is a reality to live with for a couple of years or a decade. Now I'm not so sure anymore, because if you look at just essentially, if you connect the dots, the Germans are ramping up solar tenders to up to 20 gigawatts by 28. The Dutch are doubling their offshore wind capacity until 2030. We've seen similar moves in Italy. Across Europe, companies and governments are pouring billions into climate measures and the energy transition. So I guess what this really means is that on the demand side, we'll see a fuel switch to the extent that you can replace molecules in heating and in power generation, and that will destroy demand for gas. And that's a reality Russia has to live with going forward. And all of that is massively accelerated at this point. Mm.
So, Chris, if this does backfire, does Russia risk becoming an economic pariah, as the UK has said it will do? And does it risk Putin's very future?
I think when you say backfire, I think it is now absolutely inevitable that Europe will buy less Russian energy, regardless of what happens next, but regardless of, you know, what happens to sanctions, et cetera. I think that's now, that game is now changed for good. But in Russia, it's also a case that Russia does not want to be as dependent on Europe as its major energy customer either. And for example, since 2014, when Europe started talking about Russian energy risk, in Moscow, the conversation was about also Russia's exposure to Europe as an energy customer. And since 2014, we've seen major projects being built focusing on China in gas and oil and LNG. And the discussion in Moscow right now is acknowledging that Europe is going to become steadily a less important customer, but Asia, China, India in particular, are all going to become bigger customers and compensate. So the view in Moscow is that this is about rebalancing. It is inevitable that Europe will go down as a customer, but it will be compensated with new customer growth elsewhere. That's the way they're looking at it right now. So therefore, the view in Moscow is that it's rebalancing and it's not going to destroy the economy. But clearly, it all depends on scale and time and the urgency that this will all be rolled out over.
Ole, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point. This is something we work a lot with our clients as well, trying to understand the rerouting capabilities for Russian natural gas. And what we have seen, just speaking of how it looks like looking right now, is that we see that we have around the export capacity going east into China. That's around at max 400 terawatt hours per year. If you compare that, what's going flowing into the Western European market through the Yamal pipeline, the Nord Stream 1 pipeline, and also the major Brotherhood pipeline going through Ukraine, that's around 1,700. So then you get the idea of the scale of the European market, and that's a really, really interesting interesting topic that I totally agree. Russians are really, really reliant on us as well. But we also see that there is expansion plans for example, the Power of Siberia, a huge pipeline going into China, that's scheduled to come online at around 2030. It's more than 8 years. So I think it's important to have that in mind. Just as of now, Europe is just too large customer.
Yeah, all plans do seem to be hinging on 2030. It's going to be interesting to see how many of them can be and will be sped up to deal with this particular crisis. Andreas, if there was ever a time to invest in renewable energy, it's now, or rather it was before now, with the climate crisis ever present and now these supplies of fossil fuels uncertain. Are we seeing enough effort down that road?
Well, I mean, I think it's the best time ever to do that, particularly in Europe and in places where government support is being ramped up and where you not only have an economic case, but also a strong security case now, a national security case, as some politicians would make it. But I think the one bottleneck here, obviously, is global supply chains. And what we have seen is some of the material and some of the parts that are needed to really ramp up renewable capacity are not available because of various bottlenecks across the globe and because of the knock-on effects of a COVID crisis still. So, you know, on the one side, we have aspiration and good business cases and I guess great opportunity, particularly in Europe and in the OECD world. But on the other hand, we face serious constraints when it comes to delivering. And I guess that's something that that many European markets have to grapple with going forward.
And Ole, you know, there's talk of filling in a short-term gap as you shift from gas with coal. And if we're sticking with the climate crisis for a moment, I mean, this is going to ensue a massive rise in greenhouse gas emissions.
Yeah, definitely. This is really, really bad for the environment. You know, if we go back a few years time, at least the last 4 to 5 years, you know, ESG and environment has been everything on the agenda. It's been all about the environment all the time. And now we see that suddenly it's all about the security of supply, you know. Cost whatever it costs, you can burn whatever you find, you can burn old car tires, you can burn whatever you have in mind, it doesn't matter. Now it's all about surviving and making sure that the industry keeps on delivering. So environment and prices set aside, and then you have the secure supply, which is top of the agenda as of now. And also back to the question you mentioned here, is that, you know, if you look into renewables, if we look back in the historical, we see that the historical average power price in the European Union has been around 40 euros per megawatt hours, you know, and coming out of COVID and coming out of this war crisis, we see that we are likely to have the average power price with somewhere between 70 and 100 euros per megawatt hours. You know, this is huge. This is also because at the time of COVID and at the time of the war, we have been having increased the prices for carbon cost. So definitely going back to the question regarding renewables, this is really big business for renewables, and you will have they'll basically be a massive cash machine in building renewables and generating power from renewables at these levels.
Just slightly off topic, but interesting nonetheless, Chris, is there much drive for renewables in Russia?
It's been a really interesting debate in Russia up to now, where on the one side you've got the very powerful kind of hydrocarbon sector, the big oil companies, the big gas companies, essentially have been saying that Russia should take its time about moving into renewables, that the world will still need oil and gas, you know, right into the middle of the next decade, and Russia needs to invest more in oil and gas supply. Mm. And then you've had the emerging, of course, force talking about renewables and the inevitability of a final reduction. So it's been a big debate and a big battle in Russia. Clearly, you know, one of the consequences of this conflict will be an acceleration in investment in renewables. That's absolutely clear. We have simply no idea as to how that will play out in Russia as a theme also when the crisis ends. But for sure, it's something that will again have to be addressed. But before crisis, it was a debate, but without any clear conclusion.
Mm. Andreas, campaigners, they say one of the problems with renewables is the cost, and that the government must protect the very poorest from energy price rises. I mean, we're going to see energy price rises anyway with the Russia invasion of Ukraine and stopping the flow of gas to European nations. But what can governments do to protect consumers?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I think the first thing that that governments should be doing is incentivize savings, and they are not doing enough. At the moment, governments across Europe rely on the price to deliver savings, but savings will not necessarily always come through simply because the price is high. To some extent, because the signal isn't direct, but indirect, sometimes there is no necessity on the demand side responding to price hikes. And so the government can do a lot of things. And I would start with industry just to make sure we don't end up in a situation where rationing is important and becomes the name of the game. And I think European governments can do a lot more here to shield consumers. But on the other hand, you know, we have a whole policy toolbox to do that, and we have tested it during COVID. Just think about checks that were sent to poorer families or lower income households to buffer some of the consequences. You can do this in a very targeted way. You can lower taxes on electricity, for instance, and that is a direct subsidy, if you will, to lower income households, simply because they spend an over proportional share of their income on energy services. And so there's lots of things that you can do. What you should not be doing is essentially just, you know, regulate the price across the board and just make sure the price hikes are no longer felt by consumers, because that in the end, you neither trigger savings nor shield the right people.
Okay, such an interesting discussion today. Thank you very much to all of you for joining us. Andreas Goldthau, Chris Wiefer and Ule Valby. And thank you too for watching. You can see the programme again anytime by visiting our website, that's aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, do go to our Facebook page, that's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is at AJInsideStory. From me, Laura Kyle, and the entire team here in Doha, it's bye for now.